It's now my very great pleasure to introduce Judge David Harvey. He was appointed as a judge of the District Court of New Zealand in, 1988, so he's been there for a while. He's a graduate of Auckland University and University of Waikato. He's got a long time interest in computers and information technology, and indeed has something of a reputation in this area. He's actively involved in the introduction of information technology for the judiciary since 1990. I know a little bit about that because at one time I was consulting with the Law Society and just how difficult that was to take. And has consulted formally with the Department of Justice and subsequently the Department of Courts on behalf of the District Court. So, Judge Harvey, thank you.
Thank you for that. One of the advantages, I guess, of all of the recent flurry of publicity is that it gives speakers like me a bit of material to work with. And there are three editorials that have been recently published in the Herald and the Dominion, which I think sum up some of the issues that we are talking about today. The first one from the Herald, it's the New Zealand, not the Auckland, is of the 13th of November 2009, which was a commentary on what's-his-name, the whatever-he-was, celebrity person. And I think really what you're doing is you're summing it up by saying, well, this is all about open justice. The next, of course, is the futility argument, or the internet actually negates the whole concept of suppression, so let's forget about it. Might I also make a plea that editors don't split their infinitives? That's a Fairfax newspaper, by the way, isn't it? And the final one has to do with jurisdiction and suppression. Well, why should we bother? Because we can't do anything about it anyway, because it all happens offshore. And that, again, is in the New Zealand Herald. And I'd like to address each of these issues as I go through. So arising out of this and what I'm going to talk about are the themes of open justice and the ineffectiveness of court suppression orders in the internet age. And when I say the internet age, I say that advisedly because I think we're operating in a slightly different paradigm from where we were, say, 20 years ago. And I think you've got to recognise that when you operate in different paradigms or when there is a paradigm shift, you're communications technologies actually have entirely different properties and compel different types of behaviour as a result of that. And I don't think anybody's actually done anything deep about this. Professor Elizabeth Eisenstein did when she studied the impact of the printing press on early modern Europe in a work that she wrote back in 1968. But I don't think anybody's done anything on it as far as the internet is concerned. And, of course, we're in the middle of this change thing, so it's rather difficult to start working it out. But as far as open justice is concerned, really what do we mean by the term? And I suppose you could say that it's the right of the public to scrutinise the operation of an arm of government, because that's what the courts are. And if you drill down a little bit deeper into that proposition, it is in fact the right of the people to know how and why it is that courts come to decisions, so that there should be some sort of transparency in process, so that there's nothing hidden, there's nothing secret. And, of course, when we get to that, we find out that, of course, the press become involved. And the question that follows from that is, well, all right, but is it necessary for the press to publish absolutely everything that happens in court, or only that material which is relevant to the principle of open justice, which is the scrutiny of the process by which a court arrives at a decision? And as far as these proceedings are these principles are concerned, they've been with us for a long time. We all probably, well, some of us, remember our Tudor and Stuart history and the horrors of the Star Chamber and the villainy of the Inquisition, and those who went through the Cold War will realise about how dreadful it was that people were taken out in the KGB cells at Jasinski Square or wherever it is that it happens now, up in the mountains of Afghanistan. I suppose they have secret trials as well. But we don't like secret trials. We like open justice, and there should be transparency, and it should be public, and I absolutely agree with that. I have no difficulty with it at all. The idea of the secret court, the Star Chamber justice, is anathema to the Anglo-American experience. So we have the media who operate as surrogates of the public. I mean, it's a term, I suppose, that trips easily off the tongue, but it must be meaningful as well, because not everybody can get along to court, and not everybody actually wants to, but of course a lot of people still want to know what goes on. And most of our information still is provided by traditional news media, by newspapers, by radio, and by television. And these are monolithic organisations. They are one-to-many communication systems, which is the way, of course, that it was. In this transition period. And the result, of course, when you have monolithic organisations is that it's easy to make somebody accountable if they break the rules. If there's breach of a suppression order or a breach of an order of the court, a media organisation can easily be brought to account, and there's no problem about that. The only problem we have these days, of course, is that we've got the blogosphere and everybody becoming a publisher, and that creates some difficulties for us as far as traditional media suppression orders and enforcement are concerned. But, of course, one of the things that we do seem to grapple with from time to time is this business about a name. Othello had some interesting things to say about a name. I can't remember the full quote right now, but I think it was something about robbing somebody of everything. But really, the question is, what does the publication of a name have to do with the scrutiny of the process of arriving at a decision? And is that absolutely essential? Or is it just a question of prurience, a matter of curiosity? Because there are some concerns that do arise in this occasion. The frenzy about the publication of a name or the suppression of a name without actually examining the process by which that decision was reached. I mean, the whoever he was and whatever he did person up in Auckland whose name was suppressed, I know that a number of you may think that you know what his name is. I bet you don't know what his real name is. And the question is, of those of you who complain about the suppression of his name, how many have read Judge Paul's decision? Show of hands. One, two. There you are, you see. How many have you of you have actually scrutinised the process? From the Herald? No? You haven't read the decision? My goodness. Ah, okay. So you don't know why Judge Paul came to the conclusion that he did. Have you read the reasons why he did?
I know some of the reasons. I have not read the whole
thing. Okay. Might help if you looked at the whole thing. Okay. So, I have no problem with the idea of publishing a convicted person's name. We've got to know who the villains are in our society to protect ourselves. We've got to know those who've fallen below the bottom line of acceptable behaviour. But the question that does cause me some concern is the issue of pre-conviction or pre-trial, because we have this little problem of the presumption of innocence. And the difficulty that we have is that just by a mere appearance in court, there is frequently an assumption of guilt. Now, imagine, for example, that a person has gone through a trial and is acquitted. What is the usual public response? He got off. He got off? Excuse me, that seems to assume that he's done something wrong. But he's been found not guilty. Presumption of innocence still remains. You see, there's that sort of suspicion that where there's smoke, there's fire. And this is a cause for concern. And as has just been said a little while ago, rather eloquently by Mr. Lithgow, there can be a huge amount of damage as a result of a wrongful accusation. So what I want to talk about as far as the internet suppression issue is concerned is pre-trial publication, and I'm assuming for the moment that we have provisions for separation for suppression orders, and I'm assuming that there's demonstrable evidence that there's a threat to a fair trial if there's publication. So our expectations of our trial process are that we should have a fair trial process. I don't think anybody's suggesting an unfair trial process. Certainly the accused expects a fair trial. Fair trial is guaranteed under the Bill of Rights Act. Even the Crown expects to have a fair trial. It's a totally balanced proposition here. And as Justice Baragwana said in a trial not so long ago, an appeal case not so long ago, a fair trial trumps all. And a fair trial under our system says, well, if you're going to be convicted, you've got to be convicted on the basis of evidence, admissible evidence, that is presented in court. And often the adjudicator of a person's guilt or innocence is going to be the jury, and that is where this issue of pre-trial publicity comes into play. Because, you see, under the analog system or pre-digital paradigm, there were two factors that were of vital importance when it comes to the publicity of information, and that is what I've described as the practical obscurity of information. Warren made reference to it just a little while ago, which deals with the location and retrieval of information, and partial obscurity, which deals with the recall of information. And these are both relevant. I think you've got to remember that they are absolutely relevant when it comes to considering internet publication, because these are hangovers from the pre-digital paradigm that are challenged by the internet paradigm. And practical obscurity basically is this. I see an article in the newspaper, and then I put it out, or wrap my fish and chips in it, or whatever it is I do with an old newspaper. And then I want to have a look at it again maybe a few months later. Well, I've got to go to some central repository where they keep old newspapers or microfilm of it, and I've got to locate the particular issue, which means I've got to have some idea of the date, and it means that I've got to get on a bus or take a cab or drive into town or something like that, go to the library, look it up, actually find it, and so on and so forth, and if indeed I can. And that is what I mean by practical obscurity. There are practical difficulties in regaining or retrieving that particular information that I once read. The concept of partial obscurity deals with the recall of information. Well, I read something in the newspaper about that a couple of months ago. I don't actually recall precisely what the detail was, but it had to do with, I think, something that happened out in Otara. It's about as far as it goes. So it deals with the recall of information. And these are what jurors were able to go into court armed with, if you like, or disarmed with in the pre-digital age. And it is these two qualities that are challenged by the internet. So let's just have a look at a few myths that surround the internet and internet publication for a moment. First thing is that online newspapers are not, in fact, digital reflections of traditional media. They're quite different. They are quite different. I've spent a little bit of time over the last week or so reading online newspapers. Totally different from the regular hard copy newspaper that you read with your cup of coffee. First thing is, I don't really like to sip a cup of coffee while I'm reading an online newspaper because I might tremble and spill it on the keyboard or something. The other thing is that it's much easier to locate the information in an online newspaper than it is with the traditional one. And there are qualities about digital information in the online newspaper that are vastly different from the hard copy newspaper that you'll read over your cup of coffee or on the train. Second myth, information doesn't just appear on the internet. Somebody puts it there. The suppressed name doesn't just happen. Somebody actually goes and consciously puts the name on a website, on a blog site, or whatever. So somebody initially has to breach the suppression order to start with. Third problem. Believe it or not, the internet does exist. It exists in the real world, and it has physical aspects. The servers are actually on the dirt somewhere. And internet users, the people who use the internet, because, you know, the internet doesn't just happen. There is, believe it or not, a human interface with this thing, are subject to laws. And there are cases where offshore activity has resulted in the application of local laws. There's the case that the Solicitor General mentioned a little while ago of Gutnick and Dow Jones, or Dow Jones and Gutnick, and there is a New Zealand Supreme Court decision of the Queen and Walsh, which was a fraud case involving fax machines and offshore activity, which grounded a criminal offence in New Zealand. And essentially, if you do put suppressed information on an overseas server, you can be brought to account in a New Zealand court under Section 7 of the Crimes Act, because what you have done is initiated a course of events that can lead to the totality of elements that are needed to establish a particular breach, Section 7 of the Crimes Act. So I think that answers the jurisdiction issue. And once the information is up there on an overseas site, bringing it back into New Zealand can also ground the information in this country as well, sufficient to attract the jurisdiction of a New Zealand court. So to say that, oh, well, it's all happening offshore, we can't do anything about it, is to ignore the realities that, in fact, the law does provide us with some remedies. Now, there are a few challenges that the digital environment brings to the mix that weren't present before in the analog environment. First is the information's always there. It's referred to by some people as the document that does not die. You can always get the information, and even if it isn't on the old URL, you can get it by going to archive.org. You'll find it there. The other thing is that once you've accessed the information, you're seeing it as it first appeared, so it has that fresh quality. And the problem, of course, when this occurs with criminal investigations is that you have information that develops along the line. So that by the time you've hit the final picture, that final picture has been coloured by what has gone before. And if, as a juror, you are having a look at the way in which the investigation has gone through, you may be looking at something that is quite different from the evidence that is being presented in court. And another problem we have, of course, is the relocation of information to other websites. The information can move around very, very quickly indeed. And in this way, the internet challenges those aspects of partial and practical obscurity that I referred to before. And the internet allows basically anybody to be a publisher of information. It becomes widely circulated. And inaccuracy is another issue, because what is going to happen, for example, if a juror finds information about a particular case that in fact is wrong and is completely inaccurate? I think a science fiction writer by the name of Theodore Sturgeon advanced Sturgeon's law, which was that 90% of everything is crap. And I don't know if that's a... I suppose that's rather like saying that 80% of the lawyers at Manukau are crooks, but as Margaret Baseley has said, I don't think it's quite that high, and probably Sturgeon overstated the case as well. But to say, well, I saw it on the internet and therefore it must be true, is rather like we used to say in the 70s, I saw it on the television set and therefore it must have happened. So the fact that you have now is that with this ease of location, this information that doesn't die, a juror is able to access a news report that may be inaccurate, that may assume facts to be proven, and that may contain speculative or irrelevant information which may influence the decision-making process. And we had an example of that discussed by the Solicitor General earlier on. And this is where you get the undermining of the fair trial precepts. So, what are we going to do about it? Most of your Google sites, well, or most of your Google searches on a particular name or a particular case are going to return news media sites as their first port of call. And the reason for that is that news media sites embed metadata, which makes searching that much easier and means that they're going to come to the top of the, float to the top of the pond on a Google search. And suppression orders, as far as this type of information, will immediately eliminate this source of information. That means if you do a Google search and there is a suppression order in place, and of course it's going to be obeyed by the news media, that information isn't going to be there. So the ease with which that information is retrieved is made a little bit more difficult. Blog-based information, opinion, chat websites, people who breach suppression orders and are based in New Zealand are likely to run the risk of prosecution or sanction. Furthermore, it may well be that these sites, and I'm not saying that this is a universal proposition, it may well be that these sites are not as readily searchable by the average internet user. And once again, as I said to you before, the information doesn't appear on the internet. It actually has to get there from a New Zealand source in the first place. So that can deal with that. And what about now the offshore-based information? And this is where we get into some dangerous ground. Because blocking is one solution. ISPs are able to block access to identifiable or offshore websites. And, of course, in the course of discussions, people have mentioned to me exotic locations such as China and Iran, and the less exotic location of Australia in bringing this up. May I just retreat for a moment from the present and go to the past? There was an occasion when Thomas More was giving some advice to the young Thomas Cromwell. And More's comment, because he knew Henry VIII, perhaps a little bit better than you who watch the Tudors do, and his advice was this: tell not the king what he is able to do, but what he ought to do. I'm telling you what you are able to do. It is for you to decide what you ought to do. So you can block access to identifiable offshore websites, and it may well be that ISPs be required to block access to known websites that contain information that is the subject of suppression orders. As far as your onshore-based information is concerned, you've got your standard remedies of contempt. You could also utilise takedown notices, something that's undertaken by the copyright people who want to remove copyright material from the internet, and the suggestion by the Law Commission, of course, that it is an offence for an internet service provider to maintain publication of suppressed information once there's notice. And this is similar to the innocent dissemination issue that it was a defamation case of Godfrey and Demon Internet back in the 1990s, and I think this answers the question before. Once you've got notice, once you're seized of notice, to continue to have the information in breach of the suppression order means that you've committed an offence. And I think the parallel with the innocent dissemination argument can be drawn there. Then there is the suggestion, and this was made in argument to me last year, is that newspapers can actually take down the websites while the trial is in progress to preserve the integrity of the process. But don't think that this is the complete answer, because it's not. Information's always going to slip through. But the suggestions that I have made, I suggest to you, make the law credible, mean that it isn't going to be a laughingstock, and makes the information harder to find, and introduces the limited form of practical and partial obscurity. So to conclude, I don't suggest that pretrial suppression orders challenge open justice. I don't think they do. I think rather they enhance it. I think that the transparency of the open justice or judicial process can be maintained without the publication of all of the details. And finally, that internet content can, in fact, be managed and controlled. It is a question, however, of how far you want to go to do that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. I'll just turn my microphone here on. We're right on the edge of afternoon tea time, but I think it's worth taking 5 minutes or so to deal with any urgent questions. And remember, we've got an hour and a half of discussion to follow, so don't feel worried if you're left out. So we'll take a question over here. Thank you.
Last week, I'm a blogger and a few other things. I just want to, I guess, challenge the premise that anything can be blocked by an ISP. And it might be true if to block a particular blog, say Cactus Kate is an example. She's sitting in Hong Kong, writing on a foreign-based platform, maybe it's hosted in the USA. But these days, we tend to do most, as a blogger, we tend to do most of our writing on Twitter, which goes to Facebook and to our blogs, and is syndicated in a whole bunch of other blogs and things as well. Now, try blocking Twitter. Try blocking Facebook. And you can't block me from Facebook or me from Twitter. The ISPs can't do that. And so, and Facebook and Twitter aren't based in New Zealand. And so I guess that I would challenge the premise that the ISPs can, in fact, block content. And I would say that the horse has truly bolted, and I just wonder what your response is to that.
Okay, I haven't gone... Well, I mean, Twitter raises a whole fresh bunch of problems. For example, the bona fide journalist who's sitting in court who twitters in a person's name and it goes up onto the Herald website or whatever 5 minutes later and then 30 minutes later the judge makes a suppression order. That's really fun. I honestly don't know. You see, part of the issue, and this is why I say an online newspaper is quite different from a hard copy one. You can send your online newspaper story to your Facebook page or something like that, and it does create a challenge. I don't know if it's possible to stop your Facebook page. I'm sure if the Chinese can do it, we can. I'll tell you what, Charles Clark had it all, and I can't give you the answer, but the answer to the machine lies in the machine. There'll be an answer there somewhere. I refuse to accept that the horse is totally bolted. Furthermore, I did say that we can't get it all, but how many jurors are going to have access to your Facebook page? And what level of... Okay, so you've not put a level of privacy on your Facebook page?
Could you use the microphone? Because otherwise,
anyone can have access to
Twitter.
Your
Twitter is an open system.
Yeah.
You can make it private, but almost
sure.
Everybody makes it public.
Yeah.
But the key thing about Twitter, I have say 1,000 people following me. Mm. Bernard behind me, he's got say 2,000 or 3,000.
Yeah.
Someone else grabs hold of the thing that he's retweeted from me, and he's got 180,000 followers.
Okay.
Stephen Fry grabs it, and you're toast.
Sure. Okay. Can I make another observation? Where are you?
I'm sitting in New Zealand, but
right, okay.
I'm not always
sitting in
New Zealand.
No, all right. Well, all I'm saying is that if you're going to breach court suppression orders like that, might be an idea to stay offshore.
Well, it raises the other question. So Cactus Kate, she doesn't do that, as I understand it. But when I live overseas, if I do breach those orders,
yeah.
What's going to happen? And I think the message needs to get out there, what is going to happen as well.
Well, I guess that depends upon the enthusiasm of the system to deal with it. I mean, I'm just offering some suggestions. Many, many years ago, somebody actually published the name of a person that I had suppressed and then let me know about it. And I know the person well, good friend. And what did I do about it? Why bother? But then, of course, the thing was that there were no fair trial implications. If there's a fair trial implication, I probably would have done something.
I'm just curious about the idea of having mainstream media or newspapers, television
yep.
and radio, being
yep.
able to report on a case, control their publication of their reporting online, and not allow... not allow internet-only published media to report on that case, and whether that would breach any suggestions of open justice.
Well, if the suppression order were to say on traditional media may publish no online publication, anybody who publishes online would be in breach. I'm sorry, I see things in black and white.
That's right. I'm curious, too, how that would be managed. And my previous role before I was a blogger was the head of digital for Fairfax, so I actually
yep.
had to think about how this would operate in practice.
Yeah.
Because when a newspaper is published, often a pure digital version of that newspaper, what effectively is a PDF, a picture
oh,
of
sure.
that, is published online. And we went through the process of thinking, how do we cut that particular story out of the PDF version which is published and which is sold to subscribers of that newspaper.
Yeah.
And it occurred to us we'd be doing something like publishing a PDF with holes in it
yep.
To the audience. I just wonder if that would further the public's view of an open justice system.
I can't remember there was a newspaper publication some time ago where there was some story that was suppressed and they just had the big front page with suppressed right across it. I mean, they were making a point. I don't think that it...
It was Fiji, I think.
Fiji, yeah.
Can I also suggest there was an...
I don't see a problem. I mean, sure. if you want to abide by the law and it requires you to remove something from your PDF, then you've got to do it.
Can I also suggest that people look up a guy called Isaac Mao, who came to New Zealand 3 or 4 weeks ago, maybe 2 months ago. He's a Chinese blogger. And you mentioned in your comments that it can be done in China, so we should look for options here.
Oh, it can be circumvented too.
Mm.
Sure.
And he explained in detail how 20 million bloggers use peer-to-peer networks and proxy servers to circumvent that. And I really wonder whether all this effort is worth it.
Well, the issue that I would, or the suggestion that I would make in response to that is, okay, but how many jurors are going to be able to access that, and how many are going to know how? So, you know, once again, you've got a partial obscurity issue arising in any event. I did say that it's not going to stop at all, and there will be dedicated people who will make sure that the information gets out there. It's just a question of how easy it is to find.
We're running well over time here, but I think it's probably worthwhile going two more, Hamish and then Stephen.
Okay.
Keep it fairly brief, please.
Yeah, well, I think I was impressed when you used the expression, they go into the jury room disarmed. That is poor recall, inaccessible information.
Yeah.
Now, how does keeping people ignorant like that, or, you know, the problems with memory, and I'm having them now about what I was going to say, how does that improve the chances of a fair trial?
It improves it an awful lot, because the basis for the decision is only the evidence that they hear in court, and that's the way that it should be.
True, but there's no tabula rasa. There's no sui generis. They
no,
walk
there,
in there
with
isn't, attitudes
there, because and a juror brings with them their life experience and all of the rest of it, and their common sense, which we rely on. But as far as the particular case is concerned, they adjudicate upon the evidence that they hear that is admissible in the court. Not that they read in the newspaper, not that they read on a blog.
Well, judges must be much wiser than I understand to know what happens inside the head of 12 people in the jury.
Well, might I say that most of the time they actually get it right. Well, at least they do in my view.
Stephen Heath. I was going to follow up and comment. Hamish King, I'm probably almost in a rarity in this room. I've actually been on a jury recently, and most people in this room can't have been on a jury. So I've been intrigued today. You're almost assuming that people are going to flout the rules and not take their civil responsibility seriously and do these things.
Yep.
It is frustrating being on a jury. You are kept in the dark. Hopefully you understand why you're being kept in the dark. You have many questions that you can only talk about among yourself. And there's really nobody who can help you, because you've got to let the process run. And what I've seen today is I understand a lot of it, and I agree with a lot of it, but you are making the assumption that people are going to flout their civic responsibilities. So we're really trying to catch the people who are going to flout the rules regardless.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to flout the rules, it's a human nature problem. It's not a problem. We can use all the technology. We can be China, we can be North Korea, we can be Iran, but if you're going to break the rules, we don't break the rules. So I can, and also you don't want to penalise the people who are doing good.
Mm.
So what granularity should be applied to these people who are doing their civic duty, who are trying to take it seriously, that will hopefully reach the right decision, or at least move forward?
The problem we have is, and I agree with you, most juries do indeed take their duties very seriously, and you'd agree with that, I think, Warren. Because Warren was involved with an extensive study of juries and jurors, and interviewed juries and gathered a huge amount of very helpful data. And as a result of that, there have been some dramatic changes in the way in which we conduct jury trials. And I think there's provision in the most recent amendment for juries to ask questions.
And can I just sort of add to that really to say, is this on? Yep. To say that I think you're right, that most jurors are actually extremely conscientious in the way they go about the task, and actually they do take seriously what the judge tells them they should do and shouldn't do. And I think it's very easy to actually get distracted into what individual jurors do. I was saying to a couple of people at lunchtime, the research that we did and all the other overseas research that I'm aware of actually does point to the importance of the collective process of the jury rather than what individuals do. And actually does show pretty clearly that with relatively few exceptions, even if individual jurors go and look at the crime scene using Google Earth or bring in law textbooks to the jury room or read the newspaper or Google for prior information, they're the exception and the rest of the jury doesn't want to know about us. And therefore we can easily overestimate the extent to which that information, when it does become available, affects jury decision making, because I don't think it does very often. But I don't think that's a reason to have everything available.
Well, okay. The only answer that I would give to that, and I'm mindful of the time, is that the starting point for a sentence on a charge of sexual violation is 8 years. I'd kind of like to hope that the trial that I got, if I was facing such a trial, was a fair one and that I wasn't going to be wrongly convicted as a result of some enterprising lunatic in the jury room who decided that he was going to do me like a dog's dinner no matter what. And that's always a risk. Yeah, well, Warren said that. Yeah, 12 Angry Men. It was a good play.
Okay, good point to take a break. Thank you very much.